Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Gentlemen, Richard Martin here from Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Bright and early Monday morning, beautiful weather down in Miami. Hope things are well with you, that your weekend was as you might have expected. But I've no doubt you've had to put up with the fallout from the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is the august body that serves as a thermometer for the U.S. economy, which confirmed last Monday what we've already known for many months. We are in a recession, and we have been for a year. Thank you very much, NBER, for telling us 1 year later. Well, obviously, things have moved apace since then, and the economic crisis has deepened, and it appears that analysts and the business executives bodies are increasingly raising the prospect that we're headed for a depression, which, as of course all my listeners know, we are already in and have been for a very long time. The most recent example of this came on Wednesday when a top Chrysler executive told Congress that the failure of a major U.S. automaker could, quote, trigger a depression. Well, if that is the case, and if in fact the economic figures speak what we have already decided is in fact the truth about where we stand today, don't expect the National Bureau of Economic Research to let you know when it happens. And I quote a spokesman for the Bureau who said, "It's just not a part of the business cycle dating process that the NBER has been involved in." And if you actually go to the Bureau's website, it says, and I quote again, "The NBER does not separately identify depressions. The NBER business cycle chronology identifies the dates of peaks and troughs in economic activity. We refer to the period between a peak and a trough as a contraction or a recession, and the period between the trough and the peak as an expansion." Well, isn't that a bit like a mother saying to a child that the child can't have measles because she doesn't get involved in measles diagnosis? Or maybe the weather forecast saying there's no more rain because he doesn't do rain or forecast it. You know, the NBER is already a year late by generally accepted measures, though of course I've been saying we've been in a depression since February 2006, if you remember the day on which I stated categorically that as far as I was concerned, we are in a depression as from that day, which is actually the day when the Chinese stock market lost 10% way back in late February of 2006, and I remember that very well. You see, what do we make of all this, ladies and gentlemen? The fact is that the authorities, those people who are there to tell you the truth, they are not on your side. Because when it comes to bad figures and a bad economy and a time when you all need to be saving money, they all want you to spend and spend and spend. That's what they want you to do, and that's why it takes them a year to tell you that we're in a recession. They didn't have to take a year to tell you that. And they only did tell you that because they know it's going to get much worse. You know, if it was going to get better, they'd do what they did in 2001 and back in the early 90s. They'd tell you, oh yeah, well, we were in a recession, but we believe things are getting better right now. But of course, they want you to spend your money, ladies and gentlemen, and that's why the Treasury and the Federal Reserve gave out this money to the banks, expecting them to lend it to you so that you would go out and spend it and get yourselves into even more trouble and even more debt. It is obscene. It is truly anti-constitutional that the people of this country should be lied to by their government in this way. And there's nobody who can tell you the contrary. There is nobody who's going to stand up for you on your side and tell you, ladies and gentlemen, it doesn't matter what the Treasury or the Federal Reserve asks you or tells you or exhorts you to do. Don't do it. It's not in your best interests. It will hurt you if you do these things. Nobody's going to tell you this. It's you, on your own, through whatever means you can, to convince yourselves that you shouldn't be going out and spending money today. You know, what about the NBER forecast right now? What about all those people who have fallen into depression in the meantime? What about all those investors who didn't see their stocks at 14,000 as being at the high point and sell them and are now wallowing in losses at, you know, 8,800 in the Dow Jones? So now look at the official unemployment rate coming out last week at 6.7%. I have mentioned this time and time and time again. Ignore the figures. They are lying to you, ladies and gentlemen. They are not just ignorant. They are liars, these people. You know, if you start counting all the people that want a job but gave up, all the people with part-time jobs that want a full-time job, all the people who dropped off the unemployment rolls because their employment benefits ran out, you get a closer picture of what the unemployment is. And that number is in an index labeled U6. It reflects how unemployment feels to the average Joe on the street. And what does it say? It says that unemployment is at 12.5%. That figure was at 8.4% a year ago. And I'm here to tell you that both the U6 real figure and the U3, the so-called official unemployment number, are poised to rise further. And I consider that we are indeed at a 12.5% by what I consider fair counting. And by the time that we get to the 10% officially agreed upon unemployment, U6 is likely to be approaching 15 to 17%. And by the way, the only time job losses ever exceeded that number was during the Great Depression. All right, time to give you my information. The name is Richard Martin, and the show is Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. It comes to you from Miami. It comes to you through the studios at Progressive Radio Network in New York City. And you can reach us live by telephone through our toll-free number at 888-873-4643. I will repeat that. 888-873-4643. Our engineer is standing by. He takes your call. He asks you to hold, and then I am informed through the wonders of technology, namely an instant message, that you are online, and I will take your call as soon as possible. You are also entitled to contact us through the email service, and that you can do and have your question read out by my very good self at rmartin@gscorporation.com. That's my email address. The letters GS stand for Global Strategic, and the word corporation needs to be written out in full. Once again, my email address, rmartin@gscorporation.com. All right. If you would like to call me privately to air your grievances or to ask your questions, you may do that too. And my direct line, my number is 305-357-3625. 5575. Once more, my direct line, please call me anytime. And the number is 305-357-5575. Okay. What have we seen so far? We've been seeing bubbles in all these different markets, and of course now we're seeing a bubble in the bond market. Clearly, the Federal Reserve is buying up United States treasuries in order to put money into the system, and the money, of course, is for the moment pretty much replacing the money which is disappearing from the system through the kinds of bankruptcies and liquidations that have caused the problems that we've been seeing through the deleveraging, the unraveling, if you like, of the credit derivative markets, which have been so highly leveraged and, of course, have caused all these terrible downturns in markets that we've been seeing. So the money that's coming in is really simply replacing that. All right, well, just before I continue, we have Gene from New Jersey. Gene, are you there? And what would you like to talk to us about?
Yes. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
I wanted to ask you about, you've spoken about we're in a deflationary period.
Yep.
And I really don't get it. I mean, prices are going up, but you're talking about, like, say, commodities?
Which
prices? Because commodities are going up, especially oil and gold.
Okay.
Coal.
Let's just have a look at those two that you've mentioned, Gene. You know, oil was up, I think, at $147 a barrel. And since the summer, it's crashed all the way down to about $40 a barrel.
Oh, yeah.
Huge crash. Yeah. I mean, basically, oil has come down. Gold was up over $1,000 and is now back down at $750. So they've actually come down quite considerably. You may not have noticed this because, obviously, when prices go up, they screech about it, you know, on the news, on the television, on the radio. You see it as headlines in newspapers. You know, everybody talks about how terrible it is when prices go up. But when prices come down, curiously, they don't really tell you. I'm not surprised that you're not familiar with this, because when prices come down, people keep very quiet about that. And I don't really understand why, because it's a much better piece of news to be told that prices are coming down than that prices are going up. But I guess it's more dramatic. It's more easy to create newspaper headlines and, you know, people yelling on television about how terrible things are when prices go up. So I suppose it's easier for the media to make money out of rising prices than falling prices. No, the prices have been coming down, actually, and your question is well taken, because obviously, you know, if prices are coming down, the question is really why, and the answer is because, you know, the consumer has kind of seized up. People don't have money anymore. Banks aren't lending money. House prices have collapsed, Gene, as I'm sure you're aware. And so really what we have here is falling prices along with a money supply which has really been contracting, because every time, you know, a bank goes under, or a big company goes under, or an investment bank goes under, all of these bankruptcies have the net effect of taking money out of the system. So when there's what we call a credit crunch, which means that credit is not being made available to you or to me or to other banks, even banks between themselves are not lending money, then clearly there's really no money out there to spend. And that's why, you know, people drive a lot less. As you may have seen, there was a segment on 60 Minutes last night about how oil prices have collapsed and how oil consumption in the United States has collapsed. And I'm sure they're very worried about that in the Middle East. But basically, you know, that's what's been happening and what I think will continue to happen for a while. There may be, you know, periods where prices go up a little bit because people are encouraged by one thing or another. But they have actually been coming down, Gene.
Yes, it has. Can I ask you another question?
Yes, go ahead.
And have your comment on it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you mentioned this, but you know, the situation is not the way it used to be. Supposedly with that bailout, they put the Secretary of Treasury in charge of, like, the economy, and nobody is, and he's not accountable to anybody. He's like a czar. And then you also have a president who, you know, who's also another dictator, and basically he doesn't have to answer to anybody else. And take, for example, and how this affects the market. So last week, the plunge protection team, whatever you call it, plunge protection team, was in first force. They took advantage of, you know, this tendency to have like a Christmas rally, low volume, a lot of people out, and they were in there supporting the banks big time, and the S&P, because they needed to keep certain technicals going. And they might be even using the bailout money to do this. But they gave the banks money, and they were all supporting, say, like Goldman Sachs. J.P. Morgan is another big one, you know, the real big ones. And we have, like, a false rally. But they might take it even further because they just broke new technical support. Barney Frank is saying that there's going to be an announcement regarding. So they got all the cheerleaders coming out to push this market. They're going to try to get it.
Hello?
But there's no volume, there's no institutional investing, and they made it happen.
All right, well, let's just, I mean, you're absolutely right. I don't disagree with anything you say. I do accept one thing. I do think that this plunge protection team thing is overdone. I really don't think the plunge protection team needs to get involved at this point. There are enough people who are listening to the nonsense that's being spewed out on television and in the newspapers to feel confident enough maybe to buy this market and push it up and give it quite a considerable lengthy rally that we're in right now. I don't think we have to worry about the plunge protection team so much, but I agree with you about all these people who are not accountable to anybody. I do think that it's very sad that, you know, the Treasury Secretary can take all this money and without any real serious accountability and spread it around wherever he wants. The president, as you say, is not accountable, but that's the way the system runs. This is the, you know, this is the system of government that Americans have chosen for themselves. You know, you have to, when it's live by the sword, it's die by the sword. I mean, unfortunately, this is what you have to accept as part of the system of government here. And it was always the same. It's never really been different. I mean, Roosevelt, with his New Deal, was pretty much alone in making the ultimate decisions about what was going to happen in this respect. He employed the services of his henchmen to work out the details. But, you know, this is what happens. And, of course, it's a terrible scandal, and Congress needs to wake up and put an end to it. But they don't, because they're craven, and they just don't know anything. They're pretty ignorant people, frankly, in the main. And so I'm afraid that this is, you know, what you've got ahead of you. And it will get worse, because they will pour more money at the problem. And Obama has said that he's going to come out with this massive, you know, public works program, pouring more money, which nobody has, at a problem, which basically is the idea of, if you'll come and break my window, then we can create, you know, employment. We can have, you know, the window maker make a new window. We can have the glass factory produce more glass to put back into the window that was broken. Why don't we just go around breaking each other's windows and smashing each other's cars? I mean, that would give employment, wouldn't it? I mean, this is what works projects are all about, basically. There's no commercial incentive there at all. The government takes your money. It makes other people do things. It spends your money. And basically, you know, there's no ongoing commercial wealth created at all. They're basically taking the money, which should be going to the commercial interests, which would make, hopefully, wealth out of what they have, and just basically, like war, you know, spending the money on things which have absolutely no commercial end result. And so the system just gets worse, and the depression takes that much longer to solve. But this is all politics. What can I tell you? Thank you for the question, Gene. I appreciate it. Okay, so as I was saying, you know, basically we were talking about bankers and what they're doing right now after these recent bubbles. And of course, you know, we have the credit card debacle dead ahead of us here. You know, Americans are bailing out these banks because of their greedy and deceptive lending practices in the mortgage industry. But actually, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot more coming. And I'm sorry to say, you know, layoffs are being announced nationwide in the tens of thousands, as I'm sure you all know. And as they begin to lose their jobs, these people will not be able to pay their credit card bills. And the banks will be back for more handouts. You know, I mean, last week, on Saturday, I think I got a catalog from Casual Living, and in big, bold print on the front page, it said, buy now, pay nothing. But, of course, then in significantly smaller print underneath, it said, until April. Well, you know, that mantra has been sung throughout the credit markets over the last 10 years. The banks wave a carrot in front of the consumer and reel them in and encourage them to go deeper and deeper into debt, which, of course, they do by pre-screening customers through credit reporting agencies, mailing offers to apply and transferring balances at teaser rates or 0% financing. And they base that on a credit score, you know, not on the capacity to repay. And a good credit score doesn't equate to the ability to repay debt, as we're all about to find out. You know, I mean, there have been thousands of consumers that have credit card lines in excess of their annual salaries. Some of these people are sinking right now under the burden. Some have been fiscally responsible and have minimal amounts outstanding. You know, college kids get pre-approved offers all the time. They have no ability to repay debt, yet the offers flow in just the same. We all know how these lines are accumulated. You know, the banks in their infinite stupidity keep upping credit lines because the customer pays the minimum payments on time. You know, the students' credit lines are usually, they usually start at around $1,000 and then sort of increase over the years, up to tenfold. You know, and they had no increased earnings to support this, but the banks do it without asking and without being asked. And this is the way the banks reel in the consumer, charge interest rates higher than those charged by the mob, increase lines without the consumer asking and without their consent, and lure them into overextending. And then count on the banks to act surprised when they aren't paid back. Well, shame on them. You know, bankers don't verify income, ladies and gentlemen. The first C of credit is the capacity to repay. And it's completely ignored by the banks, just as it was when they approved subprime mortgages. You know, they ask for household income, as if other parties in the household could be held responsible for the debt. Which, of course, they cannot. And since they don't ask for any proof of income, the customer can throw out any number they think will work for them, just as they did in the liar loans for the subprime mortgages. The banks then ask, you know, whether they rent or own and how much they pay. Well, if their name is not on the mortgage, they can state zero. If they pay $1,000 in rent, they can say $500. You know, there was a time when banks asked for a copy of the lease to verify the number. And then, of course, they never ask how much of a credit line the consumer is looking for. The banker can't even put that amount into the system. There isn't any place on the application for that information. They simply put unverified information into a mindless computer, and the computer gets the person's credit score and grants them the biggest line that the score and income, so-called, qualifies for. You know, then take the case of, say, a housewife with no personal income who applies for a credit card. The house she lives in is maybe in her husband's name. She would have asked for a $3,000 credit line just to pay miscellaneous expenses and to establish some credit on her own. So the computer is told that her household income is $150,000, her mortgage or rent payment is zero. The fact that that her husband's mortgage payment is $7,000 a month, which, of course, he got into with a no-income verification loan. Well, she has a good credit score, but limited credit since she's only lived in the country for the last 3 years. Well, the system gives her an approval for a $26,000 line of credit. This has got to stop, ladies and gentlemen. People are going to be learning hard lessons over the next few years. It would help, of course, if the banks could change their behavior now before things got any worse. Tomorrow is already too late. You know, in 2003, Congress passed the Fair and Accurate Credit Transactions Act of 2003. This law was implemented through regulations issued by the Federal Trade Commission in consultation with the federal banking and credit union agencies. It requires all credit card and insurance solicitations to include a disclosure for pre-screened offers. All bankers are familiar with them. They are the dozens of credit card offers that are sent unsolicited to consumers, usually by mail. The law allows the consumers to opt out of receiving pre-screened offers by calling an 800 number. Well, of course, Congress did this backwards. It, you know, they could amend the law. The regulation should have required the consumer to opt in, if they so desire, instead of opting out. That would mean that no one would get an unsolicited credit card offer. If a consumer needs a credit card, he or she could be given an option to call an 800 number to opt in. Or the consumer could go to their local bank and apply for a credit card in person. Or the consumer could go online and apply for a credit card. The consumer could also view all the best credit cards nationally at bankrate.com. And by the way, bankrate.com is an invaluable tool for consumers. You know, there's no question that default rates are on the rise. And if Congress doesn't act today, the bankers will have their hats in their hand before we know it and doing another tap dance before the Senate Banking Committee and asking to be bailed out once again with American tax dollars. Ugh, what a mess. Oh, well, I think it's time to take Steve's latest rant, and I'm trying to find it right now because I know I've got it somewhere, but... can't find it. So, well, if you didn't take his latest rant, we'll take another rant from Steve, which came on December 1st, a week ago. Richard, Monday I watched the boy wonder and student of the Depression, Ben Bernanke, involved in a question and answer session on CNBC. In closing, he said, "This credit crunch is nothing like the Great Depression. He just has to know better. This means man's SAT score was the highest in the state. He is a doctor of economics. He seems to be an extremely smart person, so I have to once puzzle over why, as I, as one of the unwashed masses, can see that this depression will not only be worse than 1929, but it will become the depression that all depressions will be measured by. He is, however, correct in saying it's nothing like the Great Depression, as this will be far deeper. In 29, we had a positive savings. Today, we have a negative savings. In 29, the dollar was backed by $20 gold. Today, the dollar is backed by faith. When this is over, we will have almost no factory jobs to return to, no World War II to create jobs and to put us on a common course to work together. I don't know how Uncle Ben cannot see this. It almost seems his brain is too much too big for his head. Richard, I do have a question. The money given to the banks is not referred to as given. They use the words made available by the banks. If the money is only made available, I see no problem. But if the banks take money and do what banks do best, loan it out, then that is where our problems start, as every dollar they loan out becomes $9. So when I see $700 billion bailout, can I multiply it by 9, or do I have it wrong? Will all this money eventually turn up as inflation at some point down the road? Thanks for the wake-up call, your serial renter, Steve Kruger." No, Steve, the $700 billion is not money which is given to the banks. It's actually loaned to the banks on a specific a purpose for a specific reason, and they have to use this money in a context which does not have anything to do with upping the money supply on a permanent basis. So this is not regular money loaned to banks. No, it isn't. All right, then. Steve continues on a lighter vein. He says, on a lighter but more insidious note, I saw a commercial for a newer concept of the game Monopoly. This one is called Monopoly Electronic Banking Edition. Yes, Steve, I've actually seen that one too. So I checked it out on Amazon, and for $31.99, you too can have this masterpiece of indoctrination into the misuse of credit and the overuse of credit cards. The key features of the game are play with cards, not cash, now play with millions on your credit card, and they say it is suitable for 8-year-olds and up. Nothing like getting us hooked on credit cards at an early age. It would be my guess that in 30 years, the newest version of the game will be played with a chip that will be implanted in your arm at birth. I can see that the 1% of the population that run our lives will not be satisfied until the first word your child says is not ma-ma, but charge it. I really don't know how long this game has been around, but it's new to me. Perhaps I don't get out much. When I see things like this game in the marketplace promoting 8-year-olds and up, how to rely heavily on credit cards, I can't help but wonder why I don't see any consumer advocate coming out against this. It's not that I think this game will bring down our economy. Our leaders seem to have done that without the help of 8-year-olds. Another reason to be a proud American. What a sad state of affairs. Thanks for the wake-up call, your serial renter, Steve Kruger. P.S. Kudos to Frank on 12408 and his comment on B.C. Roman Empire. It made me think I was reading today's newspaper. Not a damn thing is learnt from history. Well, thank you, Steve. P.C., I would say, and to the point. Do we have anybody else calling in? No, we don't. And we're halfway through our program, so we have a couple of things here on the email, which I should like to read to you. Hi, Richard, and this is RJ writing in. Can you expand on monetizing the debt? It seems to me this means at some point the government won't be able to pay the interest on its obligations and will have to print money to pay it off. Is this the nuclear option you spoke about? What time frame will this involve? This will devalue the currency, so won't this allow people to pay off their mortgages? Thanks for your help. Please put me on your mailing list. Well, RJ, I'd love to do that, but please send me your phone number. These mailing lists are permitted by the authorities. They are nevertheless advice solicitations, so I need to have some kind of knowledge of who I am dealing with, which is why I need your phone numbers. So please send me your phone number, and I will gladly put you on the list. And that, of course, applies to anyone else who'd like to be on my mailing list. All right. Monetizing the debt, that really just means that instead of just having a debt, we'll produce money with which to pay that debt, and producing money from the Federal Reserve means, of course, they call it euphemistically printing money, but they don't actually have to print the money. They just need to add digital credits to the bank's accounts, which suffices as money. Interestingly enough, of course, there isn't anything like the amount of money in the banks that would be needed if all the depositors went in, you know, tomorrow morning to demand their money back. They could not get cash. It would take several weeks, and in fact even probably several months, to print up the amount of money that would be needed to pay people back. So basically what you're dealing with is massive credit in the system, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sure you're familiar with this. We've talked about it before. Really, monetizing the debt really just means that the Fed comes out and produces money to cover however much of the debt that they think they want to pay back. The Fed can do that. I call it counterfeit money. You can call it counterfeit money, too, if you like. I didn't see any difference between the Fed printing money and, you know, Joe Schmo down the road printing money. There's absolutely no difference. It's all just as immoral. The one is the other. In fact, we're seeing more and more cases now. I mentioned a couple of cases in England a few weeks ago of where local townships are actually printing out their own money, and that's actually completely legal, provided they don't have the face of the monarch, and they don't call it pounds, and a couple of other stipulations. But other than that, you're very welcome to start your own money and use it, and if people will accept it, no problem. It's a form of barter. It's allowed. But the way these people do it, of course, it's just immoral and disgraceful. Right now, as I said at the beginning of the show, the money they're printing off really has the effect of replacing money that's come out of the system through defaults of one sort or another. But there is theoretically a point at which the debts are repaid and the money then becomes a surplus money to the system, and that is in general what causes inflation and hyperinflation. That is something of what they might call a nuclear option, yes. Obviously, the more excess money there is, the less valuable it is. And yes, indeed, RJ, it would make people it would allow people to pay off their mortgages, but only, RJ, if they could access the money. If the banks won't lend the money to the consumer, then he won't have any more money to pay off his mortgages. And as I just said, you know, a few minutes ago, there is a credit crunch. The banks are not paying. They're not lending. They're not lending even to each other. So why would they lend to the consumer? You know, it's really not a likely scenario, and that's why we're headed into, you know, a very, very deep depression. You know, who knows where it'll end up. It's certainly no sign that we're any close to the end, you know, at this point. Mark Bruns came in. Good afternoon, Richard. He sent an email about 15 minutes ago. He says, do you think that deflation decreases in pay will replace inflation increases? Thanks and keep up the good work, Mark. Mark, I keep saying this. There is no inflation. We don't have inflation in the system right now. The authorities want you to think there is. The media supports the authorities. They always have, and they probably always will. But it's a lie. There is no inflation. Prices are coming down. Look how our first caller even thought that prices were going up. I was able to take his two examples and point him in the right direction. Deflation is death to the system. It's death to the economy. It's death to the consumer. It is a very grim phenomenon indeed, but it is what's necessary right now to cleanse the system. You know, if you're an automotive maker and you've been making cars that people don't want for the last 50 years, you deserve to go out of business. And if the people are throwing money at you to go on and on making cars that people don't want, willy-nilly, and turning up in your jet when you should be, in fact, taking an airplane, maybe going business class, you know, and then you condescendingly turn up in your environmentally correct motor vehicle, you know, I'm afraid that doesn't cut it for me. You need to go out of business. You need to be pounding the streets looking for a job, just like all those other people that you've put out of work because you injudiciously played the game of providing motor cars for people in this country that they didn't want. So all of which to say, you're not going to have inflation under those circumstances. You're going to have people out of work, okay? And as you point out, Mark, that will involve decreases in pay. There will be no inflation to account for it. Not at all. It's not going to happen. So please don't think that you're being sort of left behind by an inflationary environment where everybody's getting more than you and being able to buy more than you. It's not true. My wife went to a restaurant last night. There were two other tables throughout the whole meal with people at them. The rest of the restaurant was empty, and we saw the same thing as we walked out and looked into other restaurants. This is the greatest crisis that this country has ever experienced. And it's going to get a lot worse, and I'm sorry, but that's the message I have for you. And anybody who wants to disagree is welcome to call in or write in, and we'll have it out, but that's the way it is. I thought it might be fun. First of all, let me tell you that I think that we are looking at a bear market rally in the stock market right now. And I'm not interested in talking about the stock market in particular because, you know, that's really the concern of very few people who listen to my show. But there is an effect, that is conveyed by the stock market. As the stock market rises, the media and the pundits grab it and say, look, you see, things are getting better. The stock market's going up. The stock market was down in the doldrums, but now the stock market's going up. And why? Because it's the end of the year, and they're all optimistic about Obama, who's going to come in and solve everybody's problem, and this is absolutely wonderful, so that's why the stock market's going up. Well, of course, you know, that it couldn't be further from the truth. The stock market's going up because it's oversold. It may go up more at some point, but then if things are getting worse, I assure you that the stock market will turn around and go down much, much further, which it will do. I have no doubt whatsoever that that will happen. But this has happened before. So I thought as things get better, as the stock market goes higher, I absolutely guarantee to all of you, this is something you really need to be prepared for, ladies and gentlemen. You need to learn this now. Listen very carefully. as the stock market goes up over the next few weeks, you will hear more and more people coming out and telling you how much better things are, and that the whole of this problem is now being solved, that Obama has the answers, and that he's going to apply them as soon as he becomes president, as from day one. You have nothing further to worry about. And translated, that means spend, spend, spend. Buy nice, big, expensive presents for your kids, and go out there and, you know, get ready to buy another SUV and a motor car. See how the oil prices have come down, ladies and gentlemen. It's time to get back and buy a few more hammers. No, that's not the case. But I thought I would do at this point is to read you some of the comments of what people said both before the stock market crash in 29 and during the all-important run-up to the final moment from which the market lost about 80% of its value in 1930 up until July 1932. So remember that this is pre-1929. I'll give you the date of each absurd comment. And then once you've heard these comments, you should be schooled and basically exercised into understanding that this is the kind of nonsense that you will hear. This is 100% certain, ladies and gentlemen. You are going to hear these kinds of comments over the next 6 months. So take a deep breath and prepare for them and, you know, hold your nose accordingly and cover your ears. All right. Here's, and I've got, let me see how many I have. I've got 20. Well, I got 19, and then the 20th comment is the comment of all comments, which you can wait for with bated breath, because it's something else. All right, here we come. Number one, we will not have any more crashes in our time. That was John Maynard Keynes in 1927, one of the finest economists of his time. Number two, I cannot help but raise a dissenting voice to statements that we are living in a fool's paradise, and that prosperity in this country must necessarily diminish and recede in the near future. That was E.H.H. Simmons, president of the New York Stock Exchange, in January 1928. And then the same day, January 12th, the president of Pierce Arrow Motor Car Company, Meyer and Forbes, came out and said, there will be no interruption of our permanent prosperity. Number three, Calvin Coolidge, December the 4th, 28. No Congress of the United States ever assembled on surveying the State of the Union has met with a more pleasing prospect than that which appears at the present time. In the domestic field, there is tranquility and contentment, and the highest record of years of prosperity. In the foreign field, there is peace, the goodwill which comes from mutual understanding. Irving Fisher, this is days before the crash, in 1929, September the 5th, the leading U.S. economist in the New York Times. There may be a recession in stock prices, but not anything in the nature of a crash. Number five, stock prices have reached what looks like a permanently high plateau. I do not feel there will soon, if ever, be a 50 or 60 point break from present levels, such as the bears have predicted. I expect to see the stock market a good deal higher within a few months. That was Irving Fisher, the same U.S. leading economist in economics. October the 17th, 1929, just almost hours before the crash. Oh, well then, a week later, after the crash, Arthur Reynolds, chairman of Continental Illinois Bank of Chicago, said, this crash is not going to have much effect on business. And then, there will be no repetition of the break of yesterday. I have no fear of another comparable decline. That was the president of a big bank called the Equitable Trust Company, Arthur W. Losby, on Friday, October the 25th, 1929. Then, a good body and company market letter quoted in the New York Times, Friday, October 25th, same day. We feel that fundamentally Wall Street is sound, and that for people who can afford to pay for them outright, good stocks are cheap at these prices. Market analyst, October 30th, 1929, R.W. McNeil. This is the time to buy stocks. This is the time to recall the words of the late J.P. Morgan, that any man who is bearish on America will go broke. Within a few days, there is likely to be a bear panic rather than a bull panic. Many of the low prices as a result of this hysterical selling are not likely to be reached again in many years. E.A. Pierce, market letter quoted in the New York Herald Tribune, same day. Buying of sound season issues will not be regretted. Same day, R.W. McNeil, again. Some pretty intelligent people are now buying stocks. Unless we are to have a panic, which no one seriously believes, stocks have hit bottom. Then we get Stuart Chase, New York Herald Tribune, November the 1st, 29. Quote, the decline is in paper values, not in tangible goods and services. America is now in the eighth year of prosperity as commercially defined. The former great periods of prosperity in America have reached 11 years. On this basis, we now have three more years to go before the tailspin. Then the Times of London, November the 2nd, 29. Hysteria has now disappeared from Wall Street. Then the Wall Street crash doesn't mean that there will be any general or serious business depression. For 6 years, American business has been diverting a substantial part of its attention, its energies, and its resources on the speculative game. Now that irrelevant, alien, and hazardous adventure is over. Business has come home again, back to its job, providentially unscathed, sound in wind and limb, financially stronger than ever before. That was Business Week, November the 2nd, 1929. Despite its severity, we believe that the slump in stock prices will prove an intermediate movement and not the precursor of a business depression such as would entail prolonged further liquidation. The Harvard Economic Society, November the 2nd, 1929. Then we have the same, HES, Harvard Economic Society, November the 10th, same year. A serious depression seems improbable. We expect recovery of business next spring with further improvement in the fall. And then Irving Fisher again, November 14th. The end of the decline of the stock market will probably not be long, only a few more days at most. Then Paul Block, president of the Block newspaper chain, in an editorial said on November the 15th, in most of the cities and towns of this country, this Wall Street panic will have no effect. Bernard Baruch, cablegram to Winston Churchill, November 15th, same day. Financial storm definitely passed. Okay, now, that was number eight. Number nine, I come now to a point in the proceedings, ladies and gentlemen, which almost, I think, directly corresponds to where we are today. The stock market, having bottomed in October, November, starting to rally, just as it has right now, with the kind of comment that you can expect to hear, I think, along with all the other comments, of course, that you've heard. This is the kind of thing that I expect you will correspond to the same sort of part of the cycle where we are today. Number nine, Andrew Mellon, U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, December the 31st, 1929. I see nothing in the present situation that is either menacing or warrants pessimism. I have every confidence that there will be a revival of activity in the spring and that during this coming year, the country will make steady progress. And then Herbert Hoover in December 29. I am convinced that through these measures, we have reestablished confidence. You see, this is the kind of thing that's going to happen. You could hear these kind of comments. So get used to it, prepare yourselves, and start to laugh. Okay, 1930, this is, by the way, the U.S. Department of Labor. 1930 will be a splendid employment year. Number 10, Irving Fisher, our famous favorite economist, in early 1930, says, for the immediate future, at least, the outlook is bright. In the Harvard Economic Society again, January 1930, there are indications that the severest phase of the recession is over. Number 12, with the Secretary of the Treasury again, Andrew Mellon in February 1930. There is nothing in the situation to be disturbed about. Julius Barnes, head of Hoover's National Business Survey Conference, March the 16th, 1930. Number 13, the spring of 1930 marks the end of a period of grave concern. American business is steadily coming back to a normal level of prosperity. Harvard Economic Society, again, March the 29th, 1930. The outlook continues favorable. A couple of weeks later, 3 weeks later, same body. The outlook is favorable. Now, this is the point, ladies and gentlemen, where the bear market, a rally that followed the crash in 1929, was about to top out. This is the point at which any investor who hadn't sold his stocks could have sold without ruin ahead. It would have been the best point between the crash and the ensuing devastation to have sold your stocks. And this is what is being said, just as the market was turning round to lose 80% of its value between that point and July of 1932. So listen to these following comments. May the 1st, Herbert Hoover, President of the United States. While the crash only took place 6 months ago, I am convinced we have now passed through the worst, and with continued unity of effort, we shall rapidly recover. There has been no significant bank or industrial failure. That, too, is safely behind us. 2 weeks later, Harvard Economic Society again. By May or June, the spring recovery forecast in our letters of last December and November should clearly be apparent. Herbert Hoover, responding to a delegation requesting a public works program to help speed the recovery, June 1930. Does that ring a bell, ladies and gentlemen? Here he goes. Quote, "Gentlemen, you have come 60 days too late. The depression is over." Number 16, Harvard Economic Society again, June 28, 1930. "Irregular and conflicting movements of business should soon give way to a sustained recovery." You see, you can hear in that statement a kind of little bit of concern now, because the market's going back down again, you see. Irregular and conflicting movements. It means the bear market's taken over again, ladies and gentlemen, but ignore it. Well, 2 months later, August the 30th, "The present depression has about spent its force." So see, there, they're admitting that there's a depression, which they have just said, in all those quotes I gave you, was not to be. So now, a few months later, November 15th, now they're clearly accepting. "We are now near the end of the declining phase of the depression." Well, how nice, you know? And then again, they say a few days later, "Stabilization at present levels is clearly possible." That was the 19th. Well, 1933, President F.D. Roosevelt. This is what he has to say. "All safe deposit boxes in banks or financial institutions have been sealed and may only be opened in the presence of an agent of the IRS." Well, thank you very much, Mr. Roosevelt, and thank you, Mr. Hoover, and thank you, Mr. Mellon, and thank you all these other bozos who, just as they are doing today, were telling you how wonderful everything is and who themselves caused the problem, as they are doing today. Well, at least now, ladies and gentlemen, you have in your quiver some information to show you that it all is the same as before. History repeats itself. It doesn't just rhyme. Yes, it does indeed repeat itself. And, you know, if it takes me having to repeat the nonsense, the rubbish of the people from the past in order to get you to understand this, ladies and gentlemen, so be it. But you have seen it all before. And remember that what I always say to people who wonder why we repeat the same nonsense, the same exact mistakes that were made in the past. My answer is always that the economic cycle spans a generation gap such that those of the current generation cannot remember the mistakes of their forefathers. And those who make mistakes have conveniently died out. They are not in a position any longer to influence what is done. And that's exactly what we need today. We need people who can remember, who made the mistakes that they made way back in the early 1930s, to tell us, no, we did this wrong. This was not correct. This didn't work. Whatever you do, don't make the same mistakes again. Their ghosts are calling upon us to understand and to hearken, you know, but we don't listen. We don't follow history. We read it, and then we go and make completely different conclusions, because we say things like, things are different this time. Well, you know, now we have all the modern conveniences that we never had in those days. Of course, conveniently forgetting But the movies were in their ascendancy. Radio was in its ascendancy. Air conditioning was in its ascendancy. You know, the automotive industry was in its ascendancy. All kinds of things. The aeronautical industry was in its ascendancy. All kinds of things were happening that didn't happen before those times. I would say there's a very strong case to be made that things were actually better in those days and more profoundly different in terms of technology and discovery and invention than they are today. But nevertheless, you're going to hear, oh, well, you know, we have some sophisticated means of dealing with these things now. We have sophisticated methods of financing, which we didn't have in those days. Well, that's beginning to, you know, sound a little bit sour. But that's what they were saying, you know, a few years ago. You know, we have ways of making mortgages available. Listen to Greenspan. Listen to Bush telling you how wonderful things were and how we happened on a new way of doing things, which made things much better. Remember in the 90s how we'd reached what they called a new economy. And the new, and the letters N and E were capitalized, even by the New York Times, to tell us how we'd reached a plateau, a permanent plateau of prosperity, such as Irving Fisher would have us believe, you know, how things were going to get much, much better and wonderful, and everybody was going to live happily ever after. Didn't we learn the lesson when it came to the meltdown of the tech stock era? You know, I mean, nobody learns lessons. They don't even learn lessons from 10 years ago, let alone 70 or 80 years ago. Oh, yeah, they'll learn the lesson soon enough now. We'll have, you know, decades of inferior economic performance where people hobble along and try to make do. You know, courtesy the so-called experts, the very man in the form of Bernanke, who has made a special study of the Great Depression and couldn't come up with the right conclusions to prevent it happening, just made the same mistakes, throwing more money at the problem. Then you had Greenspan, who did his doctoral thesis on the housing market and yet was there in 2005 at the very top, exhorting people to take out these subprime mortgages, because not to worry, you know, we found ways of making it all possible, which he knew perfectly well wasn't true, by the way. He knew that wasn't true in exactly the same way that Bush knew that there were no methods of mass destruction in Iraq. These people knew and they lied to you. And they're lying to you today. And they will lie to you tomorrow. And they will go on lying to you until they have cleaned you out, ladies and gentlemen. So, you know, you need to understand these things. Because, you know, and I will continue to give you information. I will do what I can to convince you that of what you need to do, and much, much more importantly, what you must not do in order to prevent this kind of thing happening again, you know? Well, I do have another rant from Steve. I have lots more. I don't have much more emails for you, but, you know, I will collate this information. I will definitely get the stuff together in order to help you understand what's going on, and more importantly, to realize that these things which happen now are systemic in the way in which we do things here, and in which, by the way, in which the whole world does things. There is no difference between the way in which people behave in Europe, in the Americas, in Asia. Believe me, it is all the same. There are not 100 ways with which to lead one's economy, in or out of trouble, or good times. You know, people are greedy. This is the nature of the world. People, you know, want to be one up. They want to be better than their neighbor. And they want to be, you know, more loved, or more appreciated, or make more money. This will never end. And therefore, I can assure you that anybody who is preparing to be around for another 70 or 80 years, it'll be a piece of cake when it comes round again. Don't worry about it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the end of our show today, and I've enjoyed talking to you, as always, and I will be back with you on Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. I look forward to it. This is Richard Martin of Richard Martin's Wake Up Call saying bye-bye till then.